Good afternoon. I'm Mason Mulling, and I would like to call the January 22nd Southern Nevada Facility Advisory Board meeting to order. Can we do a roll call before we get started, please? I hear a lot of phones beeping in, so if we could capture who is dialed in for the meeting to make sure we have a quorum. If you could call out your name and the facility you're... Actually, I'm going to have Edie do a roll call.
Thank you.
Go ahead, Edie, please.
Okay, can everyone hear me?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Do we have Boulder City Hospital? Do we have anyone from Dignity Health?
Yes, Laura Hannum, present.
Thank you. Do we have anyone from HCA? I have Todd and an alternate for Adam here. Is Jeremy Bradshaw on the line? Do we have anyone from Michael Callahan Federal Hospital? Do we have anyone from Monta Vista?
Yes, Curtis Ohashi on the line.
Thank you. Do we have anyone from North Vista?
Yes, Vincent O'Reilly here.
Thank you. Do we have anyone from Ross and Neal? Dr. Gallatin? Okay. UHS Valley Health Systems. Do we have anyone other than Mr. Freehoff?
Yeah, this is Rob Freimuller, Summerlin.
Thank you.
Samuel.
Ryan Jensen, Desert Springs.
And Claude Watts from Valley.
Thank you. And do we have Peggy with the VA?
Yes, this is Peggy.
Thank you. We have quorum.
Thank you, Edie. I appreciate that. Next, I will move to item number two, public comment. This is time reserved for the general public to speak on agenda items appearing on today's agenda. You have 5 minutes. Is there any public? Seeing none and hearing none, we'll move on to adoption of the January 22nd agenda. Can I have a motion to approve today's agenda, please?
So moved. So moved.
Thank you, Tom.
Second.
Thank you, Leonard, for the second. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Thank you. Next, we'll move to item number four, is approving the items on the consent agenda, and the only item that we have on the consent agenda is our last meeting minutes from October 23rd, 2018. Can I have a motion to approve the minutes from the meeting on October 23rd, please? Can I get a second, please?
Second.
Thank you. All in favor?
Second.
Aye.
Thank you, Sam.
Can I, this is Vince. Can I have one change? I'm shown as present and absent. I got in late last time, so I should be off the absence.
Okay. Okay, yes. Thank you, Vince. We'll make sure that's duly noted, and I do recall you dialing in. And thank you, Vince.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, next we're going to move to our report and discussion and action under item number five. First agenda item, we're going to review and discuss and recommend hospital requirements for medical students and residents from Dr. Joe Iser, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Hardy approached me probably about 6 or 7 months ago and mentioned the fact that each hospital system has sort of a slightly different set of requirements for either related to TB screening or immunizations and the like. And he talked about wanting to put together a BDR, but I think he decided against that. But I thought I'd bring it up here to see if there was some way that we could make a generalized set of requirements for, these are for medical students and or residents from all of the systems going to each of the hospitals. I understand, I know that HCA probably has a national standard, I'm not sure, I don't know if Dignity does, but maybe there's a way that, my suggestion is can we put together a small group of us to talk about those, bring Dr. Hardy in and maybe the other medical schools or at least UNLV to talk about how difficult that makes it for them. I know when their students come to us and when their or when residents come to us, oftentimes they haven't been fit tested. So that's one of the things we do for them is to fit test residents and medical students. And we can continue to do that. I don't think that that's terrible for us to do. It's not that much work for us to do for the ones that we get in here. Although I would recommend that whenever you have a medical student or a resident come into your facility who may not have come here, that they be fit tested. I don't know if that's one of your requirements, but so that was just my suggestion. Can we get together? Would there be an interest in bringing together three or four of the systems to talk about what the differences are and if we can bring them together? It might be that we look at that there are this many from one hospital system, this many from one hospital system, so we do all of them from the top to the bottom. That may be what the group may decide in order to meet your own requirements. Yours are your own, so because you're not affiliated with a larger hospital system. So,
Dr. Heiser, would you recommend a small group from the hospitals meeting with the medical school?
Yeah, we'd be happy to host it here. Bring in someone from UNLV. Roseman isn't quite there yet, but from Touro in particular. I think that now that Touro has expanded their class size, that it's a little bit more onerous for them. And how many of you take in their PA students? I assume many of you do.
From Touro?
From Touro. I don't know. We take in all of them, so we end up fit testing, I believe, all of them here. And APRNs would have, I would think we should look at what APRNs, PAs, DO, MD students, and residents. So if you're interested in trying to come up with a standard set, I think this would be an opportunity for us to do that.
Any discussion? I know the Sunrise Health System has students and passing through, and Valley Health System is aligned with Touro. I think we certainly would want to work to a solution and not have a regulation put in place. So,
absolutely.
But I'll open it up to discussion.
You all have your own residency programs, too, that might be different from one another.
I think it's a good point and very worthwhile exploring. I think if we get our chief medical officers or a representative from our facilities to sit down, would be a good use of time.
Has there been an inventory that's been collected yet?
Not yet.
Okay.
But if that would be the next step, is let's do an inventory of what you all require, each hospital system does, so that we know what each one does and which other ones don't. I think one of the issues that came up, and I can't remember what hospital system it was, is that there was a student that Dr. Hardy had, and this was after this discussion with him, but just maybe 2 months ago, a student who had been diagnosed as having latent tuberculosis. And so he asked me, what is the proper follow-up on each year with that? And what I know to be the proper follow-up is not what the hospital was requiring. They were requiring an x-ray or something else, that since they were latent, that what we do with our own people would be a review of symptoms on an annual basis, which is much less onerous than having to get a chest x-ray every year. And that might be, you know, tuberculosis is one of our specialties, so we might be able to help this systems look at what they're requiring.
Okay.
And so that would be a good first step, and get an inventory and see what the differences are. And I agree with Todd to have representatives from each of the systems and have some representation, and at least it's a good starting point to have some dialogue.
Any comments on the phone? Or if not, we'll direct the team to be able to go ahead and put that meeting together and provide some guidance and bring in the two major medical schools, Touro and UNLV, into the conversation.
Okay. And I'd suggest Dignity, HCA, and Carla would assign someone for the Valley Hospital Systems. Does that seem adequate? Are you,
sure.
Do you want to come to?
Yes, yeah. We'll, okay. We've got our policies and provide some insight,
okay,
as well.
So, well, we can work on a note to go out to the hospital systems. Thank you very much.
Great. Thank you, Dr. Heiser. Moving on to item number two, receive and discuss a legislative update from Dr. Joe Heiser.
So what I know is what we're doing, and what I think a little bit of what NSMA is doing, a little bit of what our partners, the American Heart Association, likely the American Lung Association, the American Cancer Association, the Nevada Public Health Association, and then beyond that, I'm a little bit out of my league as to what may affect you all. Be happy to do some research for our next meeting on that, although the next meeting is in a couple of months, so we'll be at least midway through. So we have a fairly it's broader than what it's been in the past. In the past, what we've asked for is some funding for our EMS and trauma system because we're underfunded for that mandate. What we asked for was some funding for vector control. And this year, what we did is we went to the legislature, all four health jurisdictions, so the state, Carson City, Washoe County, and us, and we did a three-part presentation. One was on the community health assessment, which you all have adopted, the community health improvement plan, which I think most of you or your predecessors were at and helped us to develop. So that was what Mickey Aker presented to them, what a CHA, what a CHIP is. Kevin did a presentation on what's called Public Health 3.0, and that's basically the health officer as the chief health, as the chief model. I'm not quite sure what, a convener for health-related issues, I guess much like what we're doing here today. And then the third piece was on the fundamentals of public health. And that's the presentation I did, and it was, I might have given you this presentation in the past, but what we did was to talk about what are the basic things that public health has to do, no matter what state you're in, no matter what jurisdiction you're in. Epidemiology, disease investigations, environmental health, even though environmental health isn't always part of the public health department, but we all have to do environmental health. We have to do some chronic disease related to tobacco and obesity and a variety of other things. And so we followed up on what the state of Washington and Seattle was doing, and we did that for a couple of reasons. One is that they're way ahead of us, 2 or 3 years ahead of us in doing this. Second of all, they're like us because they don't have income tax, but they prioritize health much more than our state tends to do. And the third piece is that Seattle is the overwhelming giant in the room, much sort of like we are for the state of Nevada. And we did a presentation. We talked about what these fundamentals usually look like. We wanted to set in motion a study to look at these, to cost them out for us as a state. But as a placeholder, we asked them for $5 per capita per year. And so they agreed, the Interim Health Committee agreed to go forward with that as a BDR. It is a BDR, and I think it's BDR 529. And they do state $5 per capita. So as we get closer, and if you all want to speak up on our behalf, that would be very helpful. Like I mentioned, compared to Seattle, compared to the state of Washington, Nevada and Southern Nevada Health District are way underfunded for the things that we need to do. When we look at $5 per capita, that would end up being, if you think that we have, and I do, 2.2 million people here, that's about $11 million that we're currently not getting. Go back 10 years ago, and what we were getting from our property taxes back then was $10 to $11 million more than what we're getting now. So over the last 10 years, we alone have lost about $100 million in tax revenues, which means we couldn't do a whole bunch of the things that we would like to be doing, probably that you would like us to be doing as well. So that's our big legislative agenda. It has to be tied into the community health assessment and the community health improvement plan. Luckily, ours are fairly broad for our improvement plan, and we're in the process of doing that again. Our improvement plan consists of chronic diseases, so you could put $11 million into that. I'm exaggerating to make a point, but we would really make a difference if we could do that just in Southern Nevada and decreasing the rates of chronic diseases in the state as a whole. The other piece is access to care, and I think that we all know that that's been an issue for the state as a whole, but maybe we could find ways to help support residency programs down here, as well as our own residency program that we're coming up with. And the third one was funding and public health funding, which this would be the end result of that. So that's what that big proposal is. Then we're looking at Mike Sprinkle, who is the chair of the Assembly Health Committee, is putting forward a couple of things related to tobacco, e-cigarettes, and marijuana. He wants to add marijuana and e-cigarettes into the Nevada Clean Indoor Air Act, which is one of the things we've been advocating. I think that we would get a whole lot of support from, at least for the marijuana piece, from the casinos. Even though it's not legal to smoke there, it'd be nice nice for them to do that. I know that restaurants, when I've talked to restaurants when I go out to eat and I see people vaping, they say, well, we would like to tell them not to, but there isn't any law. So they would like to be able to say no to vaping as well. And as you probably know, vapors, the chemicals that are in the underlying solvent and are toxic. They oftentimes, you can have odorless marijuana or CBD kind of oil in there. And we've had, Mike's group has had a bunch of teenagers come in and have a round table about how they do these, I think it's the Juul type device, which looks like a little thumb device, and they do it at home, and they do it at school, and no one knows if they're doing it, either with tobacco or marijuana. And part of his bill would make, it would be tobacco 21, meaning that you have to be 21 years of age or older in order to purchase tobacco products in our state. So that's a thing that we're going to have on our legislative agenda in 2 days for our Board of Health to approve. Concomitant with that is Julia Ratty, who is the chair of the Senate Health Committee, is putting forward a proposal to bring is to bring the vapes or e-cigarettes taxes up to be on a par with tobacco. That's got, even if we don't see a part of it, but that could be what funds this $5 per capita. Even if we don't see a part of it, raising tobacco taxes, raising these kinds of taxes prevents kids from starting early. And if you think of these three drugs, nicotine, I'll use vapes and whatever, and marijuana, is the longer we can postpone someone from starting up with those drugs or alcohol, the less likely it will have a deleterious effect on the developing brain. So we think that we're going to have a really hard push for this. There will be, I can't remember the name of the group, but there's a group that has taken on Juul as a client, or Altria, or whatever the one who owns it, and so it will be difficult. Altria. So that'll be a push, but we think it's worth it. And the other thing that we do think that you would probably like us to be involved in is, if Medicaid rates come up, can we influence increasing Medicaid rates? Your doctors will like that. You will like that. And so that's pretty much the agenda that we have going this fiscal year, or this legislative year. So I'd be glad to send this out to you. It's on our Board of Agenda, a Board of Health agenda for 2 days from now. And so, Amy, maybe we can get that and send it out to you. It's already posted for the Board of Health agenda. And if I thought about it, I would have sent it to you before now.
Dr. Iser, is there any PDRs that pertain to those items that are already been numbered and labeled for?
Yeah, we'll get those out to you now. The only one that I know of is 529 for the it's called the Public Health Improvement Fund. It's sort of like a block grant, but it's called Public Health Improvement Fund, and we'll get that out to you too.
Any questions for Dr. Iser? Thank you for a thorough report, and it sounds like you've got your plate full, but definitely good initiatives for this year. Any questions for Dr. Iser related to that?
Well, one comment if I could, and I was going to make some comments during the emerging issues, but since you raised Medicaid, Medicaid reimbursement continues to be an issue for acute care hospitals and also providers, you know, here in the state. The Nevada Hospital Association, we have that listed among our top, if not our top priority. As for acute care facilities being reimbursed at 57 cents a dollar of cost is unsustainable.
I agree.
So any efforts to help stabilize Medicaid reimbursement, bring it back closer to the national level of 89% of cost-based reimbursement would be very much appreciated, and allow for continued investment in technologies, services, and care that's already available in the town.
We figured you would be in support of that. NSMA is as well. So when you get providers and hospitals on the same side, I think that's a win.
A win-win.
And Dr. Izar, obviously you'll be up in Carson City advocating for those issues, so if you want to let us know if you're up there and we can coordinate to support you on those visits, just reach out to us and we'll get it out to the membership to see if we can make ourselves available as well.
Good. And our lobbyist works with your lobbyist, who works with the tobacco lobbyist, who is Michael's last name?
Hackett.
Michael Hackett. And he's working on all of these issues with us as well. We're trying to get in to see the governor, but he's maybe going to be harder than our previous governor to see, at least for the next several months.
Very good. Thank you, Dr. Izar. And next, we'll move to item number 3. Discuss and recommend facility participation in emergency room syphilis screening from Dr. Vit Krushauer. Doctor, do you want to come up to the podium and mind introducing yourself and take us through your PowerPoint?
Yes, thank you so much for having me. My name is Whit Krushauer. I'm a medical investigator here, Southern Nevada Health District, Office of Epidemiology and Disease Surveillance. I would like to thank all of you for giving me the opportunity to talk to you. I know you have, as hospital CEOs, you have a lot of competing priorities, but I just wanted to discuss one issue that's something that's become an issue nationally, but it is also affecting Nevada, and that's congenital syphilis. Like many states, our rates of congenital syphilis are rising, and the causes of this are probably multifactorial, and so we're exploring many different ways to intervene on this issue. So let me give you a little background first. Before I go on, I just want to say that what I'm talking to you about today is just part of a larger effort by the state to reduce congenital syphilis rates. And we are the Southern Nevada Health District, working with the state, has also this year about to lead a big public awareness campaign. We're taking efforts to do academic detailing, making sure physicians are sort of up to date on the latest regarding prevention and treatment of congenital syphilis. But let me go on. Oh, and one last thing. So my background as a physician is I'm an emergency department physician. I'm not practicing clinically here in Nevada. I've only been here for 6 months. But I've always, felt that the patients who come to emergency departments, they're the same patients you see who have a lot of all the health problems we're talking about, infectious disease problems, chronic disease problems. And so I think, so the topic of infectious disease in emergency departments has always been a little bit near and dear to my heart. So these are not the official statistics that we report to the CDC. So the data and statistics in this presentation from our surveillance data is just more for informational purposes to give you sort of a broad overview of trends. Congenital syphilis is being called a highly avoidable, potentially devastating event as a priority for public health prevention efforts. It's syphilis that's passed down from the mother to the infant and can potentially cause some very severe neurologic, skeletal, visceral abnormalities. It can lead to prematurity, stillbirth, and infant death. So as I was mentioning before, the rates have been rising nationally since about 2013. And our data from Southern Nevada shows reflects this trend as well. You see that this year we are sort of on record, or last year I should say, 2018, we sort of broke our congenital syphilis records for at least the last since 2013. And Nevada was ranked second in the country as far as congenital syphilis rates, and first in the country for primary and secondary syphilis. So, the rise in congenital syphilis really just reflects the rise in women of childbearing age who are contracting syphilis. So the prevention of congenital syphilis has always sort of hinged on adequate prenatal screening. So in Nevada, it is required that people who are providing prenatal care screen on their pregnant women on the first prenatal visit, and they also rescreen women at high risk. Actually, I believe they rescreen all women in their third trimester as well. And we also recommend early screening in third trimester, because the earlier you treat it, the more you can prevent ill effects to the infant or to the fetus. But one of the issues is that what we're finding is that about 50% of women who deliver babies with congenital syphilis are not receiving prenatal care. And my guess is this number is actually an underestimate, because some women receive suboptimal prenatal care, or they're insufficient prenatal care, I should say. So they're going to, they're starting their prenatal visits later. They may be skipping visits. So about 50% of the women being diagnosed with syphilis in pregnancy who go on to deliver babies with congenital syphilis are diagnosed at delivery or at the hospitalization where they're delivering. And And another issue is that so the majority of women who have syphilis during their pregnancy are asymptomatic, so they have latent syphilis, and so this is not something where, you know, they develop a lesion or something that prompts them to go to the hospital specifically for that reason, where they would receive a diagnostic test for syphilis. So a big challenge is to, you know, figure out how to identify these women who are infected with syphilis during their pregnancy but who are skipping prenatal care or unable to get prenatal care. So from a review of our data from 2017 and 2018, we see that 56% of all mothers with congenital syphilis cases sought care in hospitals during their pregnancies. 70% of these visits were at two locations, which was Sunrise Hospital and UMC. And I think this just reflects that, you know, these hospitals are providing care for a lot of patients who are disadvantaged, who for whatever reason are not able to get to prenatal care. A lot of these patients have drug issues. About a third of the mothers who went on to give birth to babies with congenital syphilis had methamphetamine abuse. And a lot of these women who are not receiving prenatal care are going specifically to the emergency department. Sometimes, if it's later on in pregnancy, they're being screened in obstetric emergency departments or the triage units, OB triage units. And then if they have, you know, severe illness, they're being admitted. Now, as part of this analysis, I looked at hospital visits that were during pregnancy, were likely when these patients or these mothers were infected with syphilis based on their syphilis diagnosis date and the stage of syphilis, and early on enough during pregnancy to allow for treatment to prevent congenital syphilis. And according to CDC, that's about 30 days before delivery. And I calculated that there were about 19 missed syphilis testing opportunities, and 18 of them were in the emergency department. And now, the term missed syphilis testing opportunity, I'm not implying that there was any blame or anything like that, or these physicians weren't doing their job. It's just these women happened to be in the emergency department during their pregnancy. They met these conditions, and, you know, this is an opportunity where if we were able to craft an intervention, maybe we would be able to intervene on these people to prevent congenital syphilis. Now, like syphilis in Nevada, you know, the broader population with syphilis, you know, it tends to be more male, men who have sex with men, female or women are like a smaller proportion. And then among women with syphilis, you know, pregnant women with syphilis is an even smaller portion. So, you know, if we were to craft some sort of emergency department screening intervention for syphilis, you know, the priority patients, in this case, would be pregnant women with syphilis. And so, you know, I checked the records to see if these women, if the physicians who were taking care of them were aware that they were pregnant. And in the emergency department, the physicians were across the board, they were aware that these women were pregnant. These women were coming for, you know, reasons such as abdominal pain, sometimes UTI symptoms. Rarely were they there for STD or presenting because they wanted an STD test. And so we're talking about syphilis screening and not, we're not, you know, diagnosing them based on their symptoms. And so a screening intervention on pregnant women would be mainly women who are pregnant and haven't had prenatal care yet. So women who are diagnosed with pregnancy in the emergency department, or women who are there for other complaints, and through history, you know, we find out that they haven't had prenatal care yet. Also women who are high risk, such as previous STD history, multiple sex partners, drug use history. You know, these other things, these other populations, like the general population of reproductive age women with syphilis, or you know, the broader population, such as men who have sex with men, you know, these are things that would be nice in the future, but our main priority is the pregnant women who haven't had adequate prenatal care. But for women with syphilis, you know, any woman of reproductive age who presents with the emergency department, it would be nice to be able to have the opportunity to screen them, and then other emergency departments who are patients who are high risk. Now, I was reviewing literature on this topic, and emergency department and public health screening interventions, you know, it's sort of like it's a difficult place to institute these sort of interventions, because it's, you know, it's not really in line with the sort of core emergency department, emergency medicine mission. But at the same time, it is a population, you know, that is very high risk. And so, you know, we do have some history of successes, and I know UMC is in the works of doing HIV screening in their emergency department. So the opportunity is definitely there, and I think precedent has been set to do, you know, public health screenings in emergency departments. Now, from us, I do not claim to know anything about what it is like to be a CEO and run a company. I was just thinking of this mainly from my perspective as an emergency department physician. So, you know, as far as my conversations with emergency department physicians. So, you know, cost is one issue. When we reviewed insurance data from these patients, we found that that the majority of them were Medicaid patients. Most of them, almost all of them, had some form of insurance. There were only a few that were self-pay patients. So even though reimbursement may be an issue, there, you know, these patients are covered by insurance. Emergency department throughput times and metrics are sometimes an issue, especially if you're taking low acuity patients and you know, performing screening tests that may involve a blood draw. And I was able to find evidence in the literature of, you know, previous syphilis screening intervention in the emergency department in Henry Ford Hospital in Michigan, and they were able to use rapid point-of-care syphilis tests, so, you know, that is a possibility. And even for patients, just say you use a traditional syphilis test, if you are concerned about having low acuity patients who you are, you know, doing a blood test on and then having to wait, you know, hours for those results to come back, you know, Southern Nevada Health District Office of Epidemiology and Disease Surveillance, we have disease investigators who would be more than willing to, if we are alerted that these tests have been sent off, to track down these patients and notify them of the results. And I believe a similar model is being done at UMC with the HIV tests. And as an emergency physician, I was found that syphilis testing was problematic in that, you know, if you diagnose someone with latent syphilis and they require multiple visits to be treated, you know, how do you facilitate those visits? And again, I think Southern Nevada Health District, we have a lot of resources we can offer these patients, and we can coordinate, you know, repeat visits and treatment for these patients. Yeah. So nursing resources, I think, you know, even if we were to say only do syphilis tests on patients who are already getting blood tests drawn for other reasons, I think that would be more syphilis tests than we're doing currently. And then you know, I think sometimes syphilis is in the emergency department. I think physicians tend to underestimate its importance, and I think a lot of patients are not generally aware of its importance either in this modern day and age. And our efforts, the congenital syphilis work group at SNHD and in the state have a lot of materials and promotional materials that we can help provide, and we can also provide academic detailing. We can provide any training for lectures for residents if you ever want something like that. So, and then one of the main things, you know, patients often come to the ED, they give incorrect phone numbers, they give incorrect addresses, and, you know, as far as, like, the liability and, you know, what do you do when you have a positive test and you can't track down the patient, you know, I think as an HD, we are willing to take on some of that burden as far as tracking these people down. So this is, I'm not attempting to prescribe anything. I don't think, like, a one-size-fits-all works for any hospital, but I just want to initiate a conversation and seeing if I can sort of get my foot in the door as far as, you know, doing syphilis screening in the emergency department to try and reduce our rates of congenital syphilis. And I think Sunrise Hospital and University Medical Center sees the majority of these mothers. So, yeah. So if I could just say thank you for your time.
All right. Thank you, Doctor, for your presentation and education. I will open it up to the committee to have any dialogue and discussion on this topic. Anybody want to talk about it at all?
Yes, I think with the concerns that you laid out, we would at Sunrise Hospital welcome you to come down to talk to our emergency medicine group and as well as our chief medical officer to engage in discussion on how we look to minimize and increase our screenings. Unfortunately, the rates of drop-ins and moms with no prenatal care, we see it just continuing to increase year over year, and despite lots of efforts and lots of resources, I don't see this curtailing, in fact, continuing to increase. So anything we could do on the front end, would appreciate it. You know, your comments about drug abuse as well, we continue to see that as a pretty significant issue in labor and delivery as well as in the neonatal intensive care unit. You know, so if we're able to work and track and screen syphilis, you know, perhaps we could also begin to address some of the drug use that we're seeing prenatally as well.
Thank you. Any further discussion? Oh, Laura?
One quick question. I know that oftentimes with reporting, you know, with infection control staff and existing reporting requirements, always sensitive to creating another, you know, reporting requirement, but by the same token, fully recognize how important this is. Has there been some additional thought, or is this another objective for the work group, how potentially this could be incorporated into other reporting so it doesn't feel like yet another, just to streamline and create the right interaction between the Southern Nevada Health District Sexual Health Clinic and the facilities?
I think in an ideal world, a lot of this information would get communicated to us electronically, and I know a lot of it does. In a situation like this where, you know, if you were to have physicians who were doing, syphilis testing and not waiting for the results, but, you know, wanting the patient to follow up with us, I probably want to go further than that and make sure, you know, there was some form of communication so that these patients don't fall between the cracks. But I think, do you have anything else you want to mention?
Sure, if I could. I probably mentioned to you before, we're one of the 30 largest health jurisdictions in the United States. It's called the Big Cities Health Coalition. And we took on three primary objectives over the last year. One is STDs, because we've seen this nationwide rise in all STDs, but syphilis is one of the ones that is the most important. HIV is another one, of course. And so this is one of the things that we see about 1/6 of all of the patients in the United States, because that's what we have within our boundaries of the 30 largest ones. So, the physicians who do the diagnosis are required to report to us, but the laboratories are too. I wish I could say just let the laboratory do it. it. And if that works, that works, but the physicians are required under state law to let us know as well. Now, that may be delegated to your infection control nurse or to someone else like that. We would not want to increase the burden, but when you think of the downside of not diagnosing and not reporting to us, the downside of these infants who will need care for the rest of their lives, the increased transmission of disease from this positive syphilis mother to other people. We do see it in sex workers. You know, the sex work in this county isn't legal, and that then allows the males to try to force women to have sex without protection. And that's one of the reasons that we see this. We also see it, as I think Dr. Kreshauer said, in the homeless population. And we do have other plans that we're working on, working with Turo, for example. Their medical students go out to the tunnels, and we want to train them for point of service or point of contact testing as well. We're doing this big, Marla, when is that week coming up? Is there a bill?
I don't think we have quite a date yet. Okay. We're working with Turo on which date that is.
Yeah, but I meant for the whole syphilis stuff.
Oh, it's supposed to be the second or third week in February, but
okay.
We're waiting for the state to
okay. So the state also recognizes this. The other context to give you is that no matter what happens in the state, we run the statistics. Our syphilis rates bring up the syphilis rates for the entire state, our gonorrhea rates, our HIV rates. Everything happens here controls the rates of disease in the entire state. So if we're trying to get more money from CDC, get more money from the state on these issues, and if we can do that, or if we get that $5 per capita funding, we'd be able to help with funding some of the testing that you would be otherwise maybe eating if they're not insured, or we may be able to do it here. So we're willing to step in and to help in any way we can. I don't know if that really answers your question. I started to, and then I wandered off into some other country.
No, it's very helpful, and no disagreement with any of the points that have been made. Just thinking through, I think the most important point of the presentation was the not only the early identification, but the treatment and follow-up. I mean, that to me, that's
which we can do.
Right. So just finding the right way to incorporate kind of the next step along with the reporting mechanism.
Thanks for bringing up those points. And you know, I would be happy to speak with you know, any physicians or ED directors about, you know, facilitating from our standpoint as far as making the systems as smooth and easy as possible. And, you know, I know that from the ED physician perspective, you know, you add something that takes one or two extra minutes to their workload, and it becomes, you know, unsustainable. So making things just as easy and just like a systems change. So I'd be happy to speak with anybody. Thank you.
Right. And I brought this slide of Dr. Kreshauer's back up because of the top bullet on the right, which we're not asking you to do, but you might want to consider doing this because we can treat the mother and try to prevent the congenital syphilis, but her partner likely still has syphilis. That's part of our job to go out to do. So if you have any of these patient populations who come into you, he may not ask you to do this, I would ask you to screen them as well within the capability that you have.
Yeah, just a comment and a couple of questions. Certainly, I can appreciate the importance of the issue, and I think obviously it impacts all of us, but a couple of questions. First of all, does this fall under the umbrella of the community health plan that you referenced earlier?
Well, access to care, yeah, it certainly falls under access to care, not under chronic diseases, but access to care. So how do people in those high-risk categories access care now? Not very well, not very easily. There are transportation, all sorts of issues. So that's where it would fall under the Community Health Improvement Plan. That would allow me, if we were to get this funding, to help.
Sure. And I think we're dealing with more of a complex patient population from a compliance and a follow-up
Absolutely.
Perspective. If you had another slide, if you don't mind backing up, and I think it listed the numbers of cases and the hospitals and then how many came to the ED. Are those the same patients on both sides of that table?
Yes.
Okay, that's what I thought.
And this represents all hospital visits by the mothers of congenital syphilis cases, including ones where they had already been diagnosed. So this one doesn't just break down the missed opportunities. This is just all visits.
Sure. But all the patients on the left side represent, they all came into the ED. 34 of them came into the ED?
Correct. For 34 visits. So there are some duplications where a single mother will come to.
More than one. Right.
Exactly.
All right, so I just wanted to clarify that. But, and I can certainly appreciate the intent from an ED perspective, but I think if you don't have a global plan to address the connection and the follow-up, especially with a patient population isn't that compliant, I'm not sure it's going to work, so I think it needs to be thought through.
That's why you give them to us. This is our job.
I mean, this is, I think what we're discussing is a little more of a, like a stopgap measure. In an ideal world, you know, we would get all these women to go to prenatal care, and that's an alternative way to solve the issue. But I think for whatever reason, a certain percentage of these women are not going to prenatal care, even when they probably, you know, they're Medicaid insured, so they would be able to afford prenatal visits, but, you know, they're like you said, a low compliance population. So, I agree with you. Sort of global efforts involving multiple, different providers and different systems are needed.
And we ourselves are going into primary care. We're not quite doing prenatal care yet, but as we get maybe by the end of this year, we'll be able to start to follow women who, if they're high risk, we're going to refer them out. But for normal risk, we'll be able to see them. And so the first visit, if you find out, if you do a pregnancy test, you find out they're pregnant and they don't have an obstetrician or a family medicine doc, you can refer them to us. We would like to, well, let me tell you when. It'll be at the end of this year, but this is a group we would like to follow.
Thank you, Doctor, and just some of my own comments, too, and I agree with Todd and Leonard and Laura have said, is unfortunately this is just one medical issue or social issues from the lack of prenatal care, education, access, drugs, all compound, and as Todd mentioned, it continues year over year. These type of things are happening in our emergency room, and it's driving up the NICU volume, which is the most expensive care you could possibly have. So, again, this is just one piece of a bigger issue that we see, especially on the emergency departments, as that's our entry point into the hospital. So, all very good points. Thank you, Doctor.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Okay, moving on to item number four, receive and discuss a report on the 90-90-90 initiative by Dr. Iser.
Does anyone see the mouse moving?
Yeah.
I think it's on.
Yeah, it's on.
Can I do that one? I'm not going to do that one.
There it is.
Got it. And the other one is up there too? The 90-90-90?
I know.
Oh, well then let me do this. From memory, we have a PowerPoint for the 90-90-90 initiative, and this is based on a World Health Organization approach to trying to decrease the numbers of HIV cases. Dr. Jerry Cade and I did, well, he hosted the first World AIDS Day presentation where we discussed this, and that would have been on December 1st. And then I think it was still in December, we did a press conference here too on that where Dr. Cade came. What it is a fairly simple set of objectives. The first one is of those people who we think are HIV positive, and statistically we can kind of estimate how many of those there are here in Southern Nevada. Of those, and let's say there are 100 of those who are HIV positive, what we want to do is to diagnose 90% of those. which would help us to identify the vast majority of people with HIV disease in southern Nevada. Of those 90 who are diagnosed, we would like to get 90% of those, there it is, on in the middle on antiretroviral medications. Can you put that back up? Thank you. And then of those, we want them to be on effective antiretroviral medications to get them virally suppressed so that we start to prevent the transmission of HIV from one infected person to another. There are several other kinds of things that we do here. One is pre-exposure prophylaxis, which is PrEP for those people who don't engage in safe sex or who have a partner who is discordant. One of them may be positive, one of them may be negative. We want the one who is HIV positive to be on pre-exposure prophylaxis, we want the one who is negative to be on pre-exposure prophylaxis so the transmission is much less, no matter what the viral load is. And then we have PEP, which is post-exposure prophylaxis. That's what one of your nurses or one of your doctors who suffers a needle stick would go through, or one of our nurses or doctors here as well. So this is an initiative that we're kicking off. We'll be going more and more into it. I think you're already part of this in your emergency department, and I don't want to ask you to do something else, but the same risk categories that Dr. Kushar put up there are the same risk categories that we would like you to consider testing for HIV, trying to find as many people who are HIV positive that you can find, that you can refer to us, that we or Dr. Cade and his group can get under treatment, under effective treatment, so we can start to eliminate and decrease as much as possible the transmission of HIV. So since Dr. Kreshauer had his presentation on syphilis, that's why you and we discussed trying to put this one in there too. We need the help that we can. I wish that we had unlimited resources. Even the $5 per capita doesn't give us unlimited resources, but it gives us more resources. So again, people who should we be able to get that, and you wanted to send it to our lab could do it. We would reimburse our lab for doing these tests and to try to get this 90-90-90 plan in place. It's a very simple proposal, more complex when you actually start to think it out. Leonard, as you were just mentioning, it's not very easy to do this, but if you start to think it out, and we'll have Dr. Kreshauer talk to your emergency room physicians about this plan too, since he's emergency medicine board certified, right? Wow. Board certified in emergency medicine. What he didn't brag about was that he just got his master's degree about 2 years ago from Berkeley, his master's in public health, and that's one of the reasons that we hired him into this position, so that not only do you've met Dr. Legan in the past, not only do he and I need the backup of another physician, but he can now do the prescribing within OEDS, Office of Epidemiology and Disease Surveillance, that otherwise one of the two of us would have to do. Most of it was Dr. Legan rather than me. So we're really happy to have him here and helping us with these issues. We now have another physician who's also, he's board certified in general preventive medicine and public health, and we might want him to give a presentation to you at the next meeting so that we can talk about our public health residency program that we're starting up. The first one and only one in the state.
Look forward to hearing more about that, Dr. Iser. Thank you so much. Any discussion on item number 4 with Dr. Iser? Hearing none, seeing none, we'll move on to item number 6. Chief Health Officer report, Dr. Iser, up to you.
So beyond what we've already discussed, there may not be a lot. We were just talking before the meeting started about influenza season. It seems to be about average to me. I know that you're seeing a lot of patients in the emergency rooms. We do know that we've had 2 adults die from influenza and 1 child. They won't be the only ones, is my fear and my best guess as well. So the more we can look at trying to get people in to get their influenza influenza vaccine still. Even through February, I think it's still smart to try to do that. Our influenza season starts a little bit later than many parts of the country and ends a little bit earlier than many parts of the country, but that could vary from year to year to year as well. I think that probably last time you were here, did I give a report on, my staff always makes fun of me because I give a report on vector season, and I probably, did I do that
yes,
last time?
Yes, you did.
Okay, so.
Staff is saying yes.
So,
I recall it as well.
So Edie's going like this, zip him up. It really is one of my prouder achievements that we've been able to do on behalf of Southern Nevada, is that we, as you know, We didn't have any cases of West Nile virus this year, so we'll try to maintain that record for another year.
Congratulations.
Unless you have questions, I think that we've already gone to the legislative agenda, which would have been something I would have put in here for you.
Great. Thank you, Dr. Iser. Item number 7 is Facilities Advisory Board reports. This is a time to identify emerging issues for the committee, or would you like to discuss any other issues or see anything on the next agenda? Now's the time to address that.
And sir, if I may, there may be a discussion of what you want to hear at our next board meeting.
So, Mr. Chairman, I would offer up an update from the Clark County Commissioners meeting this morning. I know that both Mason Van Helling and I were in attendance where shadow hospitals were discussed. So there are micro hospitals in the community that are not certified by the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. I think many of us are aware that there is activity at the state level related to legislature to avoid that going forward. Obviously, for me, representing the Dignity Health, St. Rose, Dominican Neighborhood Hospitals, which are CMS certified, we operate in a very different way than the model where micro hospitals go out of network with commercial payers as well as non-par with CMS, which therefore they are not beholden to EMTALA the way that all of the other hospitals in the community are. So good discussion amongst the commissioners. There is clearly a concern about those micro hospitals that have entered the market and are not moving forward with Medicare and Medicaid certification. And so there is going to be follow-up activity and discussion related to what action they may take to prevent that from happening, that they don't necessarily receive their business licenses, other associated approvals to move forward with construction. So anticipate all of us keeping a close eye on that moving forward.
Thank you, Laura, for that update. Any other comments on the phone? Any emerging issues or other topics you would like to be discussed at our next meeting?
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Yeah, probably at our next meeting will be at the tail end of the winter season, and that perhaps might be an opportunity just to review some statistics on emergency room diversions, get the health district's perspective on how the system is working, and maybe some follow-up data. So it's at the end of the year, we all could take a step back, learn what worked and what opportunities we might have to prepare for next season.
Great. Duly noted. And Dr. Iser, if we can put that on the schedule, we'll have Mr. Hammond perhaps report on that. Or
sure. Well, and some of you recall that I've had conference calls with you all about diversions, and I don't think we did last year, nor have we this year, which to me is a good sign, because there were a lot of diversions 4 years ago, I don't remember, but several years ago. Yeah. And I had to beg you all, we had a conference call, and I begged you all to please don't go on diversion related to this.
Right. Yes, if you can put that on the agenda for next time, that would be great. Any other topics or agenda items that... Okay, hearing none, seeing none, we'll move on to item number 8, public comment. Any public comment that would like to have a discussion on items that were not on the agenda? Seeing none, hearing none, I would move for adjournment.
Second.
Thank you, everyone. Thanks for everyone on the phone.
Thank you.